To Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. I'm really excited to have with me today, Patrick Ryan. Patrick is co-founder of Odin, a community-driven investment platform making investing in early stage companies via syndicates and funds radically cheaper and easier. Prior to launching Odin, Patrick spent 2 years at Crowdcube, ultimately heading up one of their business development teams. This was followed by a stint at Coca-Cola European Partners as project director for their corporate venturing arm. He is an angel investor himself and once launched a vodka brand, setting the company after 3 years of shipping out of a manufacturer in Russia. That is a story we're going to have to dig into, I think. Patrick, welcome to the show. Great to have you here with us.
Thank you. It's great to be on, man.
Amazing. So listen, Patrick, we're going to dive straight in and I'm going to switch to calling you Paddy because, you know, it is what it is. And I think formality is well too much something that we don't want to adhere to. So look, there's been an explosion in crowdfunding with each of the two major UK platforms boasting having raised over £1 billion on platform. Having been part of that growth story yourself, I'd really like to understand from you why you think we've seen so much volume starting to go through these crowdfunding platforms.
Good question. So I think it's a whole sort of multitude of factors. So if I was going to pick the top three, I would say, you know, firstly, over sort of the last 30 or 40 years, we've seen an explosion, you know, driven by software, basically, and that's created a lot of speculative capital and good ROI from that speculative capital. If you look at indexed returns from venture as an asset class, depending on what reporting you look at, over sort of a 25-year period, they're pretty much better than any index you can get hold of in the public markets by a significant margin. Now, power laws apply, right? So a lot of people and a lot of venture funds don't make good returns in the private markets. But overall, you know, it does well. So I think there's that first. And then the internet itself has a tendency to sort of push people towards this sharing model of doing everything, right? So there's a really great piece on this that I always refer to, which is called Understanding New Power. It's in the Harvard Business Review. I really recommend anyone to Google that piece and read it. But you can sort of see the internet as pushing people up a value chain of ownership from sort of co-creation of content through something like YouTube, right, where everyone creates and owns the content, through to at the top end of that scale, co-ownership of businesses and assets or organizations. So Wikipedia is a good example of that, right? It's basically owned by its community and all the content on Wikipedia is created by the community. In the middle there, you've got businesses like Airbnb and Uber and that sort of thing. And I think that combined with the third factor, which is like fucked up monetary policy by central banks and the sort of inflation and quantitative easing and what that's led to in terms of inflation of asset prices in the markets and the awareness that's generated that, okay, if you're not holding assets, you're getting poorer. So the sort of confluence of those three factors, so like tech just exploding in the last sort of 30 or 40 years and that pushing a capital into the private markets and then the yields being good. And then secondly, you know, sort of the sharing and ownership economy that the internet has created. And then thirdly, sort of quantitative easing and the inflation of asset prices that's created means like people want to own private company assets more and they're aware that they should be doing that and that there's, you know, potential upside there. And I think that third point as well has sort of made people realize that they're not really happy with like the way capitalism is run as it is now, and they want more of a stake in what the future looks like. And, you know, the main way you can have a stake in the future is to be a shareholder in the companies building the future. And, you know, I think that explains it. And then, you know, there's been sort of a perfect storm since then. You know, the regs in the UK were actually ahead of the US, but the US has now improved its crowdfunding regs as well and made it easier for people to raise money under sort of Reg CF. AngelList sort of pioneered a lot of that stuff and got the Jobs Act through. But more things have happened since then as well. So yeah, I think it's a really exciting time. Obviously, the crypto world as well. I'm not so interested personally in what the technology stack is. I think it's more like a cultural phenomenon, this idea of, you know, collective ownership of assets. And I think crypto is just like an interesting manifestation of that. The reason there's been so much momentum in crypto is it also deals with the money and central banking issue, you know, through things like Bitcoin. And then secondly, because it's not regulated and because it's liquid, liquid. The assets are very tradable. A lot of money's piled in there. You know, money will always flow to the sort of path of least resistance. And that's why, you know, I think crypto has boomed.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And actually, I mean, if I were to distill what you said there, I think it's a combination of access plus education plus software, right? Like, so effectively access plus education plus the means, if I can put it that way. So people have learnt, as you said, that, hey, you know, I better not be holding cash in my, you know, in my attic. That's a deflate, you know, that's going to deflate itself away to zero. I need to be holding assets that have incremental value or are gaining value and are compounding in value. I now can access those via, you know, these means such as software platforms like the crowdfunding platforms. And I think all of that together over the last couple of years, whilst also people have been sort of sat at home, I think for large periods of times where they're actually thinking about this stuff a bit more. And obviously we saw a couple of years ago, there were issues with, you know, people trading on some of the more public market equity platforms, you know, dabbling in options trading and that sort of thing. I think that there is always this sort of slight fear in my mind. And maybe that's because I may not look it, but I am Gen X, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, I always have a bit of caution. And one of the things I always worried about is, is whether people have, you know, sufficient information to be making those decisions. One of the things that I think, you know, you touched upon there was the difference between the UK and the US markets. And it's really interesting to me that one of the big players in the US has come in and acquired one of the UK players. Yeah, so Republic has bought Cedars. And I think we're seeing a lot of that transfer of capital also from the US to the UK and Europe in general, as, you know, as people see the value in kind of the businesses over here, which I think is really interesting.
Tech's starting to work in Europe, right? And then American investors realize that the asset prices are good here relatively, and that actually you can build Europe-wide sort of tech giants and that sort of thing. I mean, the Cedars Crowdcube merger failure is an interesting case. You know, the CMA blocking that is like one of the stupidest things I think, you know, imaginable, just because, you know, arguing that they don't have competitors is silly. Like, neither business is profitable, or was probably until last year, and their competitor is like literally every venture capital firm in the world.
Well, it's both VC as
that same thing.
Yeah, both VC as well as sort of angel investors, like just on their own.
Yeah, or you know, angel network.
Yeah, angel networks, or indeed Odin. And so let's talk about that, right? So how does Odin change the nature of funding? In your opinion, where do syndicates currently sit in the ecosystem? And it'd be great to understand what sort of startups or investors actually use the platform. And I appreciate you're relatively new in terms of longevity, but I know you've already done quite a lot of interesting stuff. So it'd be great to dig into that a bit.
Yeah, sure. So I left Crowdcube in 2019, learned a lot there, really great team. I've got a huge amount of respect for the founders, and I really love the mission in terms of what they're trying to do. I think, you know, the key learnings for me there were, like, one, consumerizing the investment process for anyone is good. Like, consumerization of everything happens with software. So all B2B software is going to become more and more like consumer software. And I think you could see that with any of like the winning products in the B2B space in the last sort of 5 years. And then the other thing at Crowdcube that I thought was interesting was only really consumer deals were working in terms of ones you'd want to get into. You know, there's the odd edge case. Like, we did a lithium mining company that I scouted out called Cornish Lithium, who may hit lithium in Cornwall and end up doing quite well. Mining companies are an interesting one, actually, like very speculative investment. They often IPO without having found any resources yet, and then that you're paying to dig the resources, and then it's zero or one with those investments. But anyway, yeah, the big deals that do well over the long term are things like Mondo, Revolut, Free Trade. You know, Chip will probably end up doing quite well as a business as well. I think Nutmeg exited. I think JP Morgan or Goldman acquired that. I can't remember who it was, but there's so much interesting stuff out there being built in areas like biotech and, you know, I mean, B2B SaaS, if you look at what VCs are very frequently investing in, and all these other things. And I think people should have access to those sorts of assets, but they're not necessarily, firstly, they're not really going to find them on a crowdfunding platform. And secondly, like, do they know how to pick those deals? So the gap for me was like something like AngelList in Europe, really. I thought AngelList had Europe pretty well covered, but actually they're really focused on the US. All their infrastructure is in the US, and they've actually pulled out of Europe in the last couple of years. So yeah, I left. I was bouncing around a few ideas at the time and did some work for Coca-Cola, which was a really interesting experience as well. And met Mary. We sort of started noodling on things. Yeah, we launched our first SPV in May of this year. We worked with Alex McDonald, who I think you know, who's the founder of Velocity Black, who've raised about $40 million, sort of Series B, UK UK startup, and he brought a syndicate in on a company called Cellar, who are a marketplace for alcoholic drinks and soft drinks for pubs and that sort of thing. And we've done about 50 deals since then for about 25 clients. We do direct stuff for startups, so they can roll up investors into a single vehicle. That's not really our focus. Our focus is more a syndicate lead coming to us, bringing a deal to us, saying, I'm investing 5K. I've got a syndicate of people. They're doing 75K in total. Total's 80K. And we need a structure so that we've got a single name on the cap table and a single person voting on behalf of all those investors. So a fund-like structure without going through the rigmarole of launching a fund. Now, we started a syndicate ourselves and looked at doing this. And we were like, okay, it's like 100 grand before you're at the races, right? And we were like, this is insane, right? So what we've basically managed to do is figure out a structure where you go through our regulated platform. We take the liability in terms of regulation. You can pool all the funds and invest in the company. And it costs as little as, you know, about £1,500 and then max £5,000, you know, or in dollars, more like 2K and then max about $7K. And we're looking at driving that lower. We've actually got a setup in the UK that's quite beneficial in terms of the level of regulatory filings that are required and tax filings and that sort of thing. It's much lighter than the US. So going through UK infrastructure, we think we can actually get the cost lower again. And that's really what we're focused on. You know, our long-term vision is, you know, how do you sort of reimagine the way value is created and distributed by making it super easy to set these structures up and deploy capital through them. And then, you know, starting with SPVs, but then also looking at funds and stuff like that, eventually you end up with a marketplace where anyone can discover any deal maker and, you know, co-invest in their deals. And then we take a bit of carry if we introduce capital, and then we make the infrastructure to run the deals, you know, as cheap as possible. So you can see that in public markets investing, right? There's these social apps, like sort of like what Wall Street Bets is and Robinhood are, like, you know, if you imagine those things together. So there's things like Common Stock, Public, eToro do follow trading. I really think that social aspect of investing will become much more important. And if you think about what venture and angel investing is, it's all about networks. So I think the bit that like all of the platforms miss, even I would argue AngelList to some extent, is like the community and social aspect of this. Because, you know, if you put all the right people in one place, then essentially what you're doing is just creating a more efficient market and more efficient flow of capital. And that means more stuff that needs to be built to build the future gets built faster, which is, you know, I think what interests me and I see as sort of the end goal here, right? Is like, how do you build more useful stuff more quickly and help founders get funded and, you know, do that.
Anyone who knows me would say that that's a mission that I'm definitely aligned with. There's a few things there that I'd like to pick up on, right? So for our listeners, so Paddy talked about Nutmeg, which was obviously a robo-advisor. It was acquired by JP Morgan. And you mentioned Alex McDonald. He will be actually joining us on the podcast at some point quite soon in the future. And, you know, I've known Alex for 3 or 4 years. He's a prolific angel investor and a really, really solid kind of solid person to know and understand. And I would definitely advise anyone who can to also follow him on Twitter, because he gives a bunch of great advice on angel investing as well. But just coming back to kind of the SPVs and the audience, as you were kind of talking through that, what it struck me as doing is yet again squeezing the venture capital market. And what I mean by that is, previously you had crowdfunding, so the likes of Seeders and Crowdcube, which Seeders was theoretically more sophisticated investors. Crowdcube probably was aimed at, I would say, kind of a bit more sort of the public market, but you know, maybe sophisticated, but probably less aware. And I think what happens when you start syndicating, you start bringing the angel investors who up until now may have their own mini networks or may even be part of a bigger network. And some of those bigger networks can be not that great, right? This gives them, I guess, the ability to pick and choose at a much, much lower cost what sort of deals they want to get into. And to your point, you know, investment is often a herd game. I mean, whilst everyone talks about being a contrarian, everyone follows. And therefore, having the community aspect of it allows for that cross-collaboration or thought process, or even following, you know, following the lead.
So I think the important point here is, like, venture is a game of power laws, right? So the top 5% of deals is where all the money are made. So you need access, right, firstly, and then you need to be good at deal selection, secondly. So it's a business very much of like curation and network. And that means that the platforms, in my view, that will win will be multiplayer rather than single player, right? So if you think of something like Crowdcube or Cedars, it's a single player platform. So the aggregator sitting in the middle picks all the deals, presents the deals to the investors invest, and the platform in the middle takes a cut. What we're doing is giving anyone the infrastructure to effectively raise money from their own network as like run their own mini version of Crowdcube or Cedars. So it's much more scalable, firstly. And secondly, that person will tend to be someone with quality access to quality deals and the ability to invest in those deals. And then thirdly, people don't invest in or follow the advice of companies. They invest in and follow the advice of people. Right. So if I know Alex and I trust Alex and I trust his judgment on marketplaces because he's built, you know, a 15 million turnover marketplace business, then and he knows what questions to ask the founder, then it's much easier for me to make a capital allocation decision and be like, I'll stick a grand into that. Right. Than for me to look at the deal on a platform, review all the deals of the deal, the details of the deal myself, et cetera. And also I know that Alex has fought for an allocation on that deal. I know that, you know, Passion Capital or, you know, Local Globe or whoever else are in there at the pre-seed as well. And I have a lot more confidence and ability to, so I can still deal pick, which I might quite like doing, right? And being there on the journey with a specific business, but I can do that with a bit more confidence. Now, what Alex gets in return is a bit of carry, right? So a share of the profits if things go well. If I don't want a deal pick, then, you know, one of the products we'll be releasing later on, once we hit sort of critical mass, is basically like a thematic product, right? So I can say, okay, I only want to do AI deals, women and climate. Right. Let's say they're my three sectors, or, you know, women or diverse or whatever you want it to be. And we'll just auto allocate your capital into a bit like Nutmeg do, right? But for private market. And I think that's what makes most sense for a lot of people, right? Because if you're thinking about allocating some of your money to the private markets, let's say you earn, you know, we're aiming for the more sophisticated end, sort of mass affluent, right? So people earning sort of 100K plus, but maybe more like 70K plus in the UK, but who are sophisticated and can self-certify as sophisticated. Maybe they've invested in some private companies before or been a member of an angel network. Probably they work in tech or in financial services. Your investments annually might be 10 or 15 grand, right? In terms of your percentage allocation to the private markets, it should probably be at the lower end, 5 to 10%, and then at the upper end, like 30, 35%, right? Most family offices, I think the average is about 18% for a family office right now. So from your 10 or 15 grand, even if you're at the upper end, you've got 5 grand annually to allocate. Right? What you should be doing is indexing, right? So the same way you stick your money in an ETF, and, you know, all my individual deals I've picked on free trade have gone to shit in the last 2 weeks, which just goes to show, right? Most of my money, I just stick it in, you know, NASDAQ ETF, S&P ETF. Like, you know, even Buffett's, even Berkshire Hathaway over 25 years has not outperformed gold, right? So like even the best in the world can't, you know, do this. So, you know, I just think what's coming for the private markets, in my view, is what Vanguard did to the public markets in like the 70s. And we basically want to power that and provide the infrastructure to do it. I think if we do that right, yes, it's a good thing for people.
I think so. To give you the example, I can't remember if I've talked about this on the podcast before. I may have done, but possibly not. So one of the things that I do on a monthly basis with my kids, so I have a 14-year-old and a 20-year-old, is we go through Cedars and Crowdcube, but probably Cedars. And you raised this point before. Crowdcube tended to kind of have a lot of consumer brand products, whereas Cedars had a bit more, I would say, sort of combination of tech plus consumer plus B2B or whatever it might be. But really, the point was to teach my kids about how to identify what might be an interesting deal, how to think about what does the market size look like, how to think about does the founder have fit with the market, does the founder have, you know, some sort of expertise that, you know, they're going to be able to execute on, and, you know, does the valuation make sense, et cetera, right? And look, for a 14-year-old, you know, a bit harder. For my 20-year-old, she's starting to get a little bit more kind of savvy with it. But one of the things that Cedars...
Man, you are so much older than you look. It's crazy.
Thank you for saying that. I started very young. No, I've been through a bit of a transformation. You'd be surprised what plastic surgery. No, I'm joking. No, but the thing that I noticed on Cedars recently, and we only put very small checks into those businesses because it literally is a learning and training experience rather than an investment experience. But of course, Cedars does have that thematic approach, right? So it has the robo select your sectors, do this. And I was looking at that and I said, that makes a lot of sense. However, I have a real problem with the deals that come on these platforms for exactly the same reasons that you mentioned earlier, in that they aren't diverse enough. And I'm not talking about diversity in terms of ethnicity or gender. What I'm talking about is diversity in terms of profile of business that often comes onto a crowdfunding platform. I get the impression that many businesses that come onto the crowdfunding platforms are there as a cheap marketing initiative as opposed to necessarily to raise the capital.
Look, man, I think people don't realize like half of VC funds don't return the fund.
Yeah, of course.
Right? Never mind like a platform like that. And, you know, without bad mouthing Crowdcube or Cedars, like one of the challenges we faced when we were working there, and I think they will possibly overcome this over time as they grow. But, you know, one of the challenges is that you end up with this top slice of like great fintech consumer companies and stuff like that. Right. And I think they did like the City Map around recently, and even that one might have been a bit, I don't know how City Mapper makes money, but great product, don't get me wrong, I love it, but you know, it's quite a high valuation. But yeah, I think you end up with a lot of businesses on there that are struggling to raise money elsewhere, or they're not really venture backable businesses, right? So like the thing about venture is for the risk profile that you're taking, you need businesses with potential for like exponential growth and increasing returns to scale, right? So like a consumer goods business doesn't tend to fit that profile. You do get outliers like BrewDog or, you know, some of the big D2C brands in the US that managed to exit. But generally, you're looking at like software or something like, you know, bio or pharma, which is a bit harder to judge. But right, you know, if someone's got a patent on a drug that becomes big, then they can sell it for $5 billion or whatever. So a lot of the business on crowdfunding platforms end up being like breweries and stuff like that. And they're great businesses for a community to invest in. But you're not going to expecting venture returns.
Yeah, you don't get the outsized returns that you would see from these kind of.
So if you're looking at it as an investment, then it's not a good place to go for that. Now, there's lots of interesting stuff happening. You know, if you look at Moonfair, there's products like that emerging, catering to smaller checks as well. So just trying to, you know, basically onboard a bunch of funds and then set up an SPV to invest as a feeder in those funds. And, you know, that's one of the things we'll be doing very soon with a couple of funds that are in our pipeline. We've actually done one already, but, you know, there was only like four people in the SPV and it was all big checks. So it didn't really democratize anything, but it was a good use case.
It's a start. And there've been a number of funds that have actually raised on platform as well, right?
Like, I mean, yeah. So Passion did it. And I had a chat with Eileen Burbage over WhatsApp, and she was really pleased with it. And, you know, I think they really, and I think it's awesome that Cedars did that. I think, yeah, the point I was getting to is indexing in the private markets only works if you're indexing like sort of top quartile. Because that's, or, you know, maybe top 50%, because that's where all the yield is. So if you can't access that, then you're sort of losing from the start. But like I said, I think the goal for crowdfunding platforms is slightly different. Like, you know, Crowdcube's mission statement is sort of like funding the wonderful. So it's just like giving the ability for any founder to go and raise money from their community and make their community into owners of the business. And the owners of the business aren't necessarily seeking a, you know, a 50x or 100x return on their investment. But I think there are people on those platforms who are seeking that, and they're a bit misguided if they think that that's the best place or the best way to find it. But, you know, when I was at Crowdcube, I was always pitching this idea of like something a bit more like curated and higher end and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think it's just, you know, different strokes for different folks. The guys at Republic actually used to be at AngelList, I think. I think it's a bunch of AngelList employees who span out Republic. And I think Naval is a shareholder in Republic as well.
Yeah. And that would make sense, because I think, you know, the other thing to kind of think about is that it's very hard to create a platform that does everything for all men obese, right? There is a...
You need focus.
Yeah, you need focus. There is a cohort of people that will dabble through the crowdfunding platforms that gives them, you know, some access to these private deals that they maybe wouldn't have seen. They don't necessarily have huge amounts of capital and they want to be able to invest 5, 10, 15, 100, you know, maybe 500 quid, whatever it is, in these deals. And to your point, maybe it is the brewery that's local that resonates with them, or they love the brand or whatever it might be that is attracted to them. You get free beers, you get the perks, but equally, you know, there is a cohort of people, and you talked about this, you know, the people that you are targeting at Odin are kind of that 70,000 a year plus sort of cohort of earners
who want to invest in like a boring SaaS company or something like that, right? Like,
for sure. And they have that, and they have the ability to write 1K checks, right? Like they absolutely, and I'm one of those. I'm absolutely one of those people. I mean, not that I earn 70 grand a year, even. Most of my liquidity is tied up in my businesses. But the point is, I do have some cash that I can, you know, put towards great deals. But it's very hard to get an allocation in a deal with £1,000, which is where syndication makes it really, really interesting.
And the other point here that I think is really pertinent in Europe is like the people who have deal access and relationships in Europe. Like the American tech ecosystem is like on steroids, right? So if you're like a VP at a scale-up company in California, you're earning like $250,000 a year or something like that, right? And you've got money to burn and throw into companies and stuff like that. Whereas here, like if you're a VP at a scale-up, you might be earning 100 grand a year or something like that. You know, so even in dollar terms, that's 150,
right? If you're lucky. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So even at sort of the top end, there's not as much money flying around. And then I think secondly, there's a more conservative investment culture generally. And then I think... But where I think there's a big opportunity is the ecosystem in terms of VCs is predominantly, you know, sort of people who haven't really got founder or operator experience so much. You know, if you look at the US, there's a great report on this by Diversity VC, you know, which is Chuck Warner and a few other people. But basically, 60%+ of US VCs have been an operator or founder. Whereas I think in the UK, this data is old and it's probably changed now, but 92% of VCs had never worked at a startup
They're more traditional money managers than they are tech operators.
And they are different skill sets, don't get me wrong. There's a great CB Insights article comparing people with operator experience and people with sort of financial services or you know, McKinsey backgrounds or whatever. And there's actually no difference in terms of their returns, but I think in Europe, like there's a big opportunity for operators because you can get access to deals, right? Like people want other operators on the cap table. So, you know, if Alex comes to me and says, I can do 200K from my syndicate and everyone in the syndicate is a former founder or operator and they've got networks in X, Y, and Z, and they're all angels who are writing smaller checks. Like I know that the most value add people on our cap table in many cases have invested some of the smallest amounts of money. So if you can get a big pool of those people, I'd love to have them on board. And I think that there will be a point where it's like, okay, I've got a choice between them and, you know, I don't know, you know, a good sort of tier one VC firm in Europe. And it's like,
I'd rather have the angels.
I can see myself leaning to, I mean, we in our next round of funding will definitely prioritize like our user base and angels.
Obviously you're going to leverage the people that, because they've shown that inclination. And look, Elizabeth Yin wrote a great Twitter thread on this, you know, the power of small check investors, small check angels. And the way she described it is often these people, and I, you know, again, I completely identify with it. Often these people are people with a chip on their shoulder, right? Like they and not in a negative way, like they have brute force capability to really lift a business forward. Why? Because they're committing money that they probably don't have, you know, a huge ton of, right? They're not massively liquid as we discussed earlier. So when they make a decision, they have real conviction about the decision they're making. And I think that's massively valuable for founders. In fact, as you know, I'm hoping to put together a syndicate for a business that I've been working with for the last couple of months. And you know, the people that have already shown interest are exactly those sort of people, right? They are, you know, they are operators at scale-ups. They are, you know, from the industry, or they are, you know, people who understand what it means to found and grow a business and therefore really want to be involved in those success stories, but don't have 10, 15, 20, 50K. They're not, you know, they're not kind of wealthy, liquid high net worth angels, right? So I think that's massively important.
But there are people with money, but they don't necessarily have access to the deals,
well,
right?
Yeah.
So like there's a lot of family offices and stuff like that in Europe, people who've made money in sort of the 20th century or 19th or 18th century, even, or 17th, just flogging land still.
Anywhere outside of London, I think, is where you're talking about, but yes.
Yeah, but they don't necessarily have like knowledge or deal access, those people, right? And like the future is being built by private companies, you know, and there's crazy things happening. You know, some of the stuff we see, you know, like SPVs coming through our platform. Like there's one recently where they're doing like what they call wet computers. So they're building computers from like
biological material, effectively.
Right? Yeah. Biological material, like, you know, like sort of growing computer brain things in a vat, right? And there's good investors on the cap table of that business. You know, the world is going to get very weird very quickly, I think, in the next sort of 50 years. You know, Azim Azhar's written a great book on this recently called Exponential.
Yeah.
And I think if you're in that ecosystem, you have access to those deals. And then on your point around sort of skin in the game, like even if you're charging carry, it's not like you're charging management fees and that sort of thing typically on these deals, right? So the incentives are very well aligned. Like you only make an upside on it in addition to what you put in yourself if everyone else does. And I mean, even when Buffett got started, I think his first fund, he charged no management fees and then a 30% performance fee, which is a very high performance fee, right? Like in terms of carry, but he's sort of backing himself and saying, and that way, you know, you've got skin in the game and an incentive alignment.
Yeah, for sure. But there is time value to that money as well, right? Like, so the fact that he's not taking the management fees means that he's sacrificing short-term fees, short-term income for long-term gains.
Which isn't something people can always afford to do either, right?
Exactly.
But like the beauty of syndicates and SPVs is you could run your deals on the side, basically, right? And then have a full-time job alongside that. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's okay. That I think is definitely where we are generally heading. And I think, again, it comes back to that squeeze of venture capital, but also the democratization of access to venture, right? So in fact, like talking about that, right? So Nothing Ventured was actually born out of, you know, taking a shot, seeing where it landed. And I'd love to understand your approach to risk-taking. I mean, you've talked a lot about kind of how you've approached investing, but risk-taking is more than just investing, of course. How do you think about risks as an entrepreneur and as an angel? And then, you know, has there been a time you took a risk that didn't pay off, and what were the learnings?
Good question. I don't think I'm the most risk-prone person. I'd say I'm like fairly measured, right? Like I like to take risks, but I'm a big fan as well of not having all your eggs in one basket and trying to spread, you know, diversify your risk. So I definitely think about it in that way, right? So I am pretty much like starting this business, I had job offers and stuff like that were good, and deciding to turn all of those down when we still didn't have a product or revenue or money being raised was definitely the biggest risk I took. And I was about to get married as well. And, you know, my wife wasn't super stoked on me not having a job. You know, moved in to my parents during lockdown and sort of cut all my rent off and that sort of thing. And I think the other thing is that's not a massive risk if you have the privilege of being able to do that, right? Like a lot of people don't. I think that's one of the problems in entrepreneurship for a lot of people is like, it's not really viable. You know, I talk to a lot of people who have come from a working class background and have a job at Google or Facebook or Amazon. You know, they're earning very good money. It doesn't make any sense for those people to take this level of risk because they've got a family to feed or whatever, you know? You know, they've got parents to look after, their parents don't have pensions, that sort of thing. So I think it's all relative. You know, if you're able to take more risks, it's probably because you've got fewer risks in other areas of your life. And then, yeah, in terms of risks I've taken that haven't paid off, there are countless ones, both business mistakes and just dumb stuff I've done in my life where, you know, I've ended up getting, you know, beaten up for saying the wrong thing or that sort of thing. But yeah, I would say, you know, spreading your risk is the main thing. And then, you know, having a bit of a plan B in place is always good as well. So yeah. And then I think once you raise money, you have a duty to your shareholders as well. So then you need to be very careful about what level of risk you take. At the same time, entrepreneurship is definitely about like living on the edge of like what's acceptable in terms of risk. And I think over time you just get like more comfortable with that, right? Like the stuff I do now that would have freaked me out like 5 years ago in terms of like, I wouldn't be able to sleep, you know?
Oh, don't worry, you'll get back there, I'm sure. It's fine.
But I personally try and like, you know, my wife's really into like yoga and meditation, and you know, I definitely do more of that. And like, I think the more you can sort of stay calm in those situations, you know, what is it? If you can stay calm when all around you are
losing their heads.
Who's that?
I don't know. That's, I'd have to dig it out. I will dig it out. But yeah, it's a great quote.
I've heard it in a best man speech somewhere recently, I'm sure. Yeah, I think learning to be a bit calm in those situations is important, and a lot of decisions or things that you worry about as risky aren't as risky as you think they are when you take a step back, you know. And if you can always take the perspective of like, I'm trying to do the right thing, and I'm trying to do what I believe to be, you know, the ethical thing to do in this situation, and always start from that principle, then I think it's okay to take risks. And, you know, just sort of remember that we're just a bunch of smart apes on a rock flying through space anyway, right?
Yeah. I don't know about smart, definitely an ape. in my case, no. Look, there's a few things.
Bored apes.
Yeah, bored apes. Exactly. I think there's a few things to dig. So the quote you were talking about was "If" by Rudyard Kipling. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you. And the poem goes on. But so a couple of things. I mean, I think one really sage piece of advice there, and I've been through this gamut numerous times, is the ability to say, it really is that ability to stay calm and divorced from whatever is happening that is negative. Whatever is happening that is negative is a thing that is happening. It may or may not be within your control, but what you can control about it is your reaction to it and how you approach it. And I'm a strong believer that how we control ourselves and our reactions is the biggest power. The agency we have for ourselves is what makes us who we are, and no one else can take that away from us. And I think there is that real sort of issue that people almost give up their agency, whether they give up agency to their employer or to the government or whoever else. And I think more of us should take more heed of that. And the reality is, yes, look, as a founder, you're always going to have, you know, am I going to make payroll? I was expecting the investment to land. Like, I had one client that we work with, you know, had raised money through the investment visa schemes. And one of their investors basically ghosted and left them with, you know, 30% less cash in the bank than they expected to have. And these are the things that unfortunately do happen, but it's how you react, I think, and how you approach the solution that tells, you know, tells how you are as an entrepreneur. The other thing that I think was really interesting that you said, and I 100% agree with, and we've talked a lot about Alex McDonald on this podcast, we're going to mention him again now, but Alex and I are launching a charity in the near-ish future, which is focused on getting cash into the hands of people who don't have the ability to take risk, right? To promote entrepreneurship, not from the perspective of giving them cash as an investment, but literally giving them cash so that they can go and open up the bakery or spend the time tinkering on the product that they want to build or have the working capital to go and buy, you know, the widgets from China that they can set up their e-com store with. Because quite frankly, most people don't have the ability, as you said, to crash on their parents' couch even, let alone, you know, take their entire family. And I say this a lot, you know, I know that I'm very fortunate that if everything were to go to hell, if all of my businesses were to fail, I would be okay. And I think, you know, the ability to be okay is not something that everyone has. And I think the ability to know that you will be okay if everything fails is what prevents people from taking risk. And I think I think that's a really important thing for us to think about, especially when we work in this ecosystem where it feels like there is cash everywhere for everyone. We got to remember that.
Yeah, and people are raising lots of money and stuff like that. Yeah, I think this is like more broadly, like if you look at, you know, Britain as an example, I think the States is quite similar. There's a massive, you don't realize that you're already in like the 1% basically. And there's a massive, you know, or at least the sort of top 10% of in terms of earners. And there's a massive gap for most people. But I think that's about more than like money. I think, you know, Blair talked a lot about education, right? And I think, you know, with what Alex is doing, the important thing there is not just the money, it's also like, can you give people the knowledge so that they can make the right decisions in these situations and that sort of thing. And, you know, in terms of what drives us longer term, you know, when I said we're thinking about how we reimagine the way value is created and distributed, you need to really think about systems and, you know, capital and you know, the economy is sort of one of those big systems. I think the other area where there's just so much potential is education. Like, it's something, I think if you look at anyone who's come from a poorer background who's come from a family and have become more successful, it tends to be something that's valued in their family. And yeah, I think there's a huge gap there that's still to be.
Yeah, for sure. Look, I mean, it's often why migrants tend to dedicate all their resources to educating their children so that they can get that step up. I have some alt ideas around education, which I won't go into now, but maybe I'll do a separate podcast on them. I think there is a big issue, certainly in the UK, just to maybe just throw in my two pennies worth. There is a big issue in the UK in that the education system was developed for the industrial age. It was developed to kind of put people into
management. The Victorians, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So it was all about shift working, getting people into factories, into managerial positions, maybe. And, you know, the whole university system was about getting into management or getting into business. You know,
it's a conveyor belt, the whole thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it tends not to teach kind of creative entrepreneurial sort of traits. So look, that is definitely something that I think...
Or just, you know, let people do what they want, right?
Yeah. Like, without pigeonholing.
There's this great anecdote. Yeah, exactly. There's this great anecdote of like a lady, I'm going to butcher this story, but it's something like she was a kid and she couldn't stop moving and she goes to see like the doctor.
Ken Robinson.
With her mum. Yeah. Is it? And she ends up being a ballerina.
Yeah. So Sir Ken Robinson.
Like running, or is it Sir Ken Robinson?
Well, no.
He
told the story. Yeah. So if you don't, I'll interject
because
it sounds like you kind of half know it. But yeah. So Sir Ken Robinson was an incredible educator. He's sadly passed away. Anyone who Googles his TED talks, there's two I think he's done. But the first one where he talks about this story is incredible. And yeah, what he described was effectively a mother had taken her daughter to the doctor. And this is going back 60, 70 years. So it was kind of predating modern theories around, you know, medicine and psychology and so on. And she said, you know, my daughter just can't concentrate in school. You know, she's always fidgeting. She just can't sit still. You know, there's something wrong. Please, doctor, help us. And the doctor had been sort of observing the daughter all the way through. And he said to the mother, you know, listen, let's just leave the room for a second. And as they walked out the room, he turned on the radio and they went outside the room. And he said to the mother, just said, wait, stop and watch and looked inside. And he'd basically put on music on the radio and the daughter just got up and had started dancing. And he basically turned around to the mother and said, your daughter doesn't have a problem. You know, she doesn't have a learning disability. She's a dancer. She wants to dance. Let her dance. And that daughter, that lady turned out, ended up as one of the premier ballerinas, I think, in the Royal Ballet, which is, it is a wonderful, wonderful story. And I think it is one of these things that we, you know, we talk a lot about STEM, but the creativity of humans is what's going to power us forward. And I think we're probably seeing a lot of that at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, that thing of like pigeonholing people. I mean, there are some basic things that you need from an education, right? I think everyone needs good literacy and numeracy. I think they're like fundamentals that just teach you to think properly. Like if you can't express yourself properly and if you can't calculate properly, then you're sort of in a bad spot, aren't you? But beyond that, like, you know, they used to in the UK have grammar schools and then, you know, sort of technical schools. And, you know, that was done away with because they felt it wasn't sort of democratic or fair. But there is some logic to it at the same time of like sort of letting kids specialize a little bit more based on what they're good at. Like that's what, but also, you know, you need general skills and that sort of thing. I think Elon Musk has invested in this girl. I follow her on Twitter, but she tweets a lot about education and she is building this sort of new version of school based on, you know, Musk had like a school in the SpaceX or Tesla, you know, sort of
on the campus. Yeah, I think so. I haven't dug into it.
And they've got these really innovative teaching techniques and they basically get the kids to like solve problems together. And the kids sort of like auto-organize into like groups based on their knowledge and skill sets and that sort of thing. And yeah, apparently it's really fascinating. And it's teaching them what you will be doing in the real world, right? Whether you're a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, a business owner or, you know, a product manager or whatever, like you're always going to have to do that stuff. And, you know, fundamentally we're a social species and we're good at solving problems together. So it's just crazy we don't do more of that in school.
Yeah. I again, as I said, I could go on a complete rant here. My children, I chose an international baccalaureate system rather than the UK system for precisely those reasons, much more sort of creative curriculum. But I'm also, again, it comes back to privilege. I'm privileged enough to be able to do that. Paddy, just before we kind of wrap up, this has been a hugely interesting and wide ranging conversation. Bringing it back to kind of Odin and what you guys are doing, what advice would you give founders trying to raise capital in this ecosystem at this time right now?
Ooh, good question. I think the advice I would give to founders based on my limited experience, and, you know, there's a lot of advice that gets thrown around, but it's like, make sure you've got something people want to buy. I did a podcast with a guy called Sahil Lavinia, who's the founder of Gumroad. Great guy. And he wrote a book called The Minimalist Entrepreneur, which he was doing sort of a podcast book tour, and we booked him as part of that. But the book's great. And like, one of the things he says there that I think is so true is like, sort of identify a community that you're probably already connected with, and then just focus on solving a problem for yourself. And it will tend to also be a problem for that community. Like, the thing that's really clicked with Odin is like, I wanted to solve this problem for me. Do you know what I mean? I was like, I want to invest in biotech companies or SaaS companies or, you know, nuclear fusion or whatever it is. And like, I'm never going to find them on Crowdcube, right? But I'd see all these VCs were investing in those businesses. And I was like, how do I solve that, right? And if you start from there, then eventually you're going to figure out a way to get there. And it took us a while to like figure out the regulatory and the market and to figure out a product that people actually wanted. And we started building product way before we should have. That's the other mistake people always make. Don't build a product. Like, don't build a product. Like Slack, Airtable, you know, Webflow, all these tools are out there that just let you get going with, you know, a bunch of processes rather than a product and without writing a single line of code. And I think at the very earliest stages, before you think about raising capital, the mistake people make is they take their great idea and then they go and build something and then they realize no one wants it.
For most people, the MVP is a spreadsheet or could be.
Yeah, it should be, right? Yeah. Right. Like, and then in terms of raising, I would say, you know, be targeted, I think, is actually important. So like, build your list and, you know, reach out to people who are actually relevant. You know, pre-seed is the hardest, man. I would not bother with VCs, to be honest, because even if they say they're pre-seed, like, they'll only really invest in your pre-seed if you're like a repeat founder or you've got like ridiculous pedigree, right? Like you're senior PM at Monzo or you're like...
Or the traction is obviously there, right? Like there is
right? And the biggest thing you can do to raise money is get traction, right? So like, build a wait list and also like, forget about fundraising, sell your product to someone, right? Like if you can get buyers, then you've got a product and that's the real test. People always put off trying to monetize or they have ideas about like, you know, an app or whatever, and they still don't have a clear business model. And I think one reason startups fail is there isn't a market need for the product, right? Like, and you need to solve that before you think about, you know, raising money. You don't need to reach, you know, perfect product market fit, but you need evidence people will pay for what you're selling.
Amazing. Paddy, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you today. I think I've learned a whole bunch. There's a few books that I'm going to pick up on the way and add to my never-ending reading list.
I've got a bottomless list as well.
For our listeners, where's the best place to find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where are you camping out on the internet?
Yeah, Twitter, I'm at @ry_Paddy, PADDY. Or you can follow @joinodin, which is our company. On LinkedIn, you can search for Patrick Ryan. You'll probably end up with about 15,000 people who look quite like me. You just search for Patrick Ryan Odin and you'll find me. I'm on there as well. But yeah, Twitter I prefer. The folks on Twitter are way more fun.
Yeah. LinkedIn's starting to find that myself.
LinkedIn is a hellhole.
For sure.
But useful.
Look, everything has its uses. But look, Paddy, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you for having me, Arisha. It was a really good time.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventure.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.